lounge room floor talking to women about babies and massage and all of that.
Yep.
All those years ago.
Right. Yeah. Hi, everyone. This is Pinky McKay here with our monthly Parenting by Heart Mummy member call. And our topic for today is love, lust, and little babies, your relationship after becoming parents. And our guest on this interview is Rhea Dempsey. Rhea is an educator, speaker, and birth attendant with experience at over 1,000 births. Rhea is a respected birth practitioner with a reputation as one of the foremost thinkers on the topic of working with pain in childbirth and its connection to normal physiological birthing. With three adult daughters of her own, Rhea's understanding of birth has been gained during 34 years working with women in home and hospital settings. Rhea's a highly sought-after speaker and presenter at conferences, seminars and workshops on birth and counselling issues. She regularly addresses pregnant women, their partners and support people, complementary health practitioners, midwives and medical practitioners. Rhea also has post-grad qualifications in counselling and offers post-birth and couples counselling here in Melbourne. I've known Rhea for, how long, Rhea? 30 years?
Yes, probably a bit more.
an awfully long time. Yes, and she's worked away at the birth and I've sat on her floor and been with birthing women and she's sat on mine and been with breastfeeding women. So
yes.
It's been complementary,
but we both sort of focused a bit more intensely into, you know, the two different areas of that whole big change process for women and their partners and families.
Really is complementary. And Rhea's probably the person I would send anybody to if they needed any birth education or post-birth counselling. If you've had a disappointing or traumatic birth experience and you need to talk it through, Rhea's your lady. And she's the author of a fabulous brand new release book, Birth with Confidence, which I have sitting here on my table. I've been through it and it's just got everything in it you need. And she addresses the psychology as well as the practical, as well as the support people and just about everything really, isn't it, Rhea?
Yes. It's a bit of a look at the what women are facing in the particular, you know, birth climate that they're facing at the moment. So I'm happy to get it out there, and it's and hopefully it will be useful for women in their decision making and just to support them really into their power in birthing.
Yeah, because you can come out of birth feeling shattered, or you can come out feeling incredibly strong and powerful and ready to go with your mothering, with you. Journey with your relationship, whatever, and it's such a big event. And those of you with babies already that are on the call, and some women haven't yet had their babies, so grab Rhea's book. Those of you who have had babies who are perhaps planning on having another one, check out the book because it's just got it all in there. And like I said, I've seen Rhea's work over a long period of time, and I've seen the women that have come through after being supported by Rhea, and they come out powerful, don't they, Rhea?
Yes. That's what we want. Powerful mothers.
Tells it like it is. So welcome, Rhea.
Good, thank you. Good to be here.
Rhea, can you tell us just a little bit about your work and how you came to have this passion for supporting birthing women?
Yes, as often is the case with people who have a passion for a particular area of life, it's often their own experiences that, and coming through a particularly difficult experience for me with my first baby. And when I came out of the birth of her, expecting it to be very straightforward, but not quite being so, and just wondering, what the hell happened there? And in the time of unpacking what had happened, I really started to become quite radicalised about birth issues, I guess. And then with my second and third babies, we're starting to put a whole different viewpoint into place for my births. And it just sort of came out of that. And unfortunately, in a way, these 35 years later, some of the same issues that I was a bit shocked by, I guess, when they happened to me with my first baby, they're still present, in that a lot of women go into the experience expecting that they're going to be supported into their strength and their power and their capacity to give birth, only to find that there seem to be blockages in the way within the system or the way other people think about it that sort of undermines them. And So anyway, that was my experience with her, and I've still been talking about the same sort of stuff and working to support women into their real capacity for birthing all these years later. So that's been the kernel, the seed of that passion that I've continued.
And it's great that you're still doing it and you still have that passion and that fire still burns. You know,
yes.
A lot of people would have been burnt out going at that strength. But I guess like me, what I see with mothers with breastfeeding support, with, you know, new baby support and all the rubbish that's out there, you go, haven't people learnt anything in the last 20 years?
Yeah.
Don't they know
yes.
anything?
Yeah. And I had
frustration.
It is frustration. For me, and maybe too for you, Pinky, as well as on that wider arena of, you know, working with other people. But my first daughter, the one that I'm talking about in terms of the catalyst for my work in birth, has just had first grandson. And
so, wow,
yes,
congratulations!
Yes, and so, you know, beautiful to see the work that I've done, not only in myself personally about birth, but, you know, the things that she's been exposed to now because of my work, and what a beautiful birth experience that was, and, you know, fantastic onto breastfeeding and all of that follow-on that we know happens when we get those straightforward and powerful birth experiences where women come out of it feeling like, I can do, rather than feeling, you know, that somebody else has to take it over or do it for me or what have you. So that's been a real treat to have
wonderful.
That. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess also, you know, in terms of keeping up that passion, I have three daughters, Pinky, so there's also that motivation about wanting to keep those changes going or make those changes so that, you know, they can have good experiences in this realm.
That's right. Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So today we're going to talk about relationships and how a baby can impact on this.
Yes.
Now, a new baby does drastically change that couple dynamic, and it can place a lot of stress on a relationship. We see all these beautiful Huggies ads and what have you with these, you know, all clean and neat and gorgeously staring into each other's eyes with this little baby in between. Well, you know, let's just talk about what really happens. And what sort of changes couples can expect the baby to bring to a relationship.
Yeah. So, of course, we have to acknowledge that some of that beautiful, the delight that's depicted in, as you say, the advertising or the photos, there is that. There is that. And for a lot of couples, men and women individually, you know, they can be taken totally by surprise about how much they fall in love with the baby and how much they also then that spills over in terms of their connection and respect and feeling of love for one another. So that, you know, we want to hold on to that, and of course we want that to be the dominant feeling within the relationship. But of course babies also bring a whole lot of other shifts and changes, both at a practical level as well as at a sort of social level and into the sort of psychology, at the deeper personal psychology, as well as the sort of psychological nature of what's going on between the couples. So there's some big changes, and sometimes that's a lot rawer than those images that, as you say, might present. So, you know, I guess in that very early time, some of the things that are at that very practical level is, of course, how tired one might be. And that's not only because the baby's waking as it needs to for its development and survival and getting its needs met, but that it's waking through that 24-hour period. So sleep and the way we sleep and the grabbing time when we're asleep, that all changes, and that can bring its own stresses at a physical level and also just at a sort of feeling like you're not quite in your same rhythm. So that can be play out with both the women and the men, which then also can mean that, you know, you're not always then in your best place for dealing with other things that might be stressful, whether that's just the change to the household because of all the things that babies require and the structure of the rhythm of the day. I mean, one of the things that helps couples to have an understanding about this is to as an educator before the birth, there's a thing that we do call the 24-hour clock, you know, and having couples before the birth to think about, well, you know, how much time do you spend on this and this and this through the course of the day, you know, the feeding yourself and, you know, your personal cleanliness and all of those things, as well as your work, as well as having some time for yourself, as well as doing shopping and cleaning and washing and what have you, and putting that into a 24-hour clock before the birth, and then put on top of that, well, okay, typical day in a baby means this to be done, this to be done, this to be done, and then see how is that going to add up. And of course, when you look at it like that, you see that it needs many more than 24 hours in a day to make that work. So so that's a big shock, I think, for a lot of, if they haven't really, particularly maybe if they haven't been around other, either family members or friends who've recently had small babies and seen what that looks like, you know, where the nuclear family takes us a little bit more into a bit isolated from one another and seeing the realities of those things. So maybe couples aren't really prepared for that, the, what that's going to mean. And so they're not necessarily planning strategically about it beforehand to either get more support in, because that's really what's required to get all that, to have that all happen. And yeah, to think in a clear way about what's needed, rather than from that sort of rose-coloured glasses about it's all just going to be sweetness and light and we're going to be in love with this baby and in love with one another without any challenges. So a realistic understanding beforehand can be helpful for the what's going to happen once the baby is here. You also said that, of course, you know, the way the birth has unfolded and the, you know, the both at the emotional level and as well as the physical energy level for the mother, the particular type of birth can be uplifting to her and really leave her, you know, with great resilience and resourcefulness. Or for some women, of course, their birth experiences are very depleting, not only of their physical energy or sometimes a lot of healing required at that physical level, but sometimes also quite undermining sometimes of their sense of confidence in themselves and their capacity. So all of those things can play into then without as much sleep as they might feel they need, and with many extra new demands being on that learning curve about learning about babies again, which, you know, maybe if she's been lucky in her life to be around lots of little babies, that's not such a big learning curve. But again, for many of us, we're not so exposed to babies before we have our first baby. And so we're on a huge learning curve about, you know, all those things that eventually become automatic. But in the early time, you know, learning how to hold babies and wash them and clean them and all of those things is not second nature to us anymore because of smaller size families and just that, that idea of, you know, living in more separate units that nuclear family life brings forward. So lots of new learnings going on and being required in a situations where we maybe don't have our full resource base, either in terms of, you know, our physical and emotional well-being, as well as getting a bit of sleep, Pinking, to help to boost our energy.
By a truck, isn't it? You've been hit by a truck or you've had major surgery or, you know, something that equivalent, even if you haven't actually had the major surgery, but something of that equivalent that you have to heal from physically and emotionally, and then you're still expected to hit the ground running.
Absolutely.
On very little sleep. And I've actually, you know, the stats show that even the most easy, easy baby will take 9 hours of basic care when you do your 24-hour clock. So that's a lot, you know. And then if you've got a baby who, you know, perhaps needs a little bit more than that, which most newborns do.
Yes.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. And that, so there's the basic care, and that doesn't also allow for the staring into the eyes and watching a new baby, and all of a sudden minutes and hours go by with, in you know, in all that, that thing of that, just that falling in love, that bonding that happens. So that's to be factored in too, some time to just really let that occur, rather than even with that nine hours of basic care, you've probably got to throw a few more hours in there about just being in love.
Just being in love and watching and gazing and skin-to-skin cuddles and all that lovely stuff that mothers should be supported to do for at least that first month, I think.
Exactly.
I had a friend who's a lawyer and they just had their baby at the weekend, but he said to me a few weeks ago, well, how much time do you think I should take off? And he owns the law practice. I said, give yourself a month off. And right. I said, factor in a month off.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, of course, we know, you know, we know much more now about that baby's development is so enhanced by all of those things. They're not, it's not just they're lovely things to do, and they're a bit of a, so you might think they're a luxury, but in fact they're really crucial in those early, not only those early weeks and months, but that first 3 years, that strong bonding is so crucial to that baby's well-being and the building blocks for its development through life. So, yep, they take time.
No, it's, not just, they take. It's not just the bonus, they are the basics. Yeah, so, you know, 9 hours is only allowing for, you know, nappy changes and feeds, really. It's not much more than a few baths. You know, it's not much more than that, whereas, you know, it is a lot to have this little person. And then, of course, the relationship of fitting that in as well, and all the changes that go on for connection and disconnection. Are there any tools parents really need in their toolbox to help with this transition from being the couple to being the family?
Yeah, well, so as I've sort of previously mentioned, really some preparation about this part of it beforehand, some realistic, you know, if they've got friends and or relatives or around who are in that realm or have been through it fairly recently in the last 2 years, really have some conversations, you know, what were the things that really helped, what were the things that you wish you'd done differently, just get some conversation about really what it's going to look like and what the demands are going to be beforehand, so a bit of insight beforehand and some discussion together at that point about how you might problem solve some of these things, or so, because of course it's much harder probably in, as we're saying, in that sense where you're really under the pump with the baby and all the changes and not much sleep, etc. You're not really full of your resilience about problem solving. So any of that can be done beforehand is better to be done. So that's one thing. Another thing is, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, Pinky, that really support. So having that network, whether it's family or friends or neighbours, or as it, you know, maybe we're thinking about the rose-coloured glasses of the good old days when we were more connected with our neighbourhoods and maybe more people were around, but somehow or other to get that support in so that, you know, the energy required for the couple to keep the vitality and the closeness in their relationship, as well as all the things that are required in terms of and wanting to offer to the baby, you know, as well as household and what have you. If that's just really the couple themselves doing that, then they're both going to be exhausted. And often then what happens is in that prioritising about where you're putting your energy, the couple relationship is really lowest down on the rung. So I think planning around support, and that can be a bit difficult because we're, you know, as a culture we feel like we're independent and we can do things and we can do it by ourselves. But there are certain times in life when having that extra support around it really makes a huge difference to our well-being, and in particular I think to the well-being within the couple relationship. So they're in the toolbox. Another one is for couples to really, I guess, shift their thinking around. Often before babies come, couples can have the luxury of being more spontaneous in their relationship. So with that spontaneity in terms of, well, how about we go and do this or we go and do that, or spontaneity in their intimacy and sexuality, or spontaneity in terms of, you know, when they might eat, or just the whole thing about spontaneity. And they often prize that well, it's delicious, of course, to be able to do it, but they prize that somehow or other as a marker about how strong the connection in the relationship is. Whereas once babies are born, and you can see there's very little time for, you know, all sorts of things, and certainly for being spontaneous in the moment, particularly around issues to do with the couple connection, that can get lost, because there just isn't time to be spontaneous in. So I think that for couples, if they can do a little bit of work on that before the baby comes and understand that, you know, putting a little bit of forethought or some planning to get some support in so that you can go out for brunch, or so that you can have a bit of time where you can spend that some moments together and plan for those rather than just assume they're going to happen spontaneously in the way that they used to, and that spontaneous happening is prized more than planned time, I think that's a big adjustment that would be very helpful in that early to sort of, yeah, really in that first year or so of the baby's life. So that would be a tool, if you like, to address that. So the support, and then just getting over that idea of spontaneous interactions being the best interactions. But sometimes just planning for making time together is it does the job just as well. Yeah. So there.
And for those mothers that have already got a baby, you know, that's a really good one about that spontaneity. Because in some ways, you know, look, the baby's asleep, quick, we can go and have Nookie and, you know, and she's thinking, oh my God, thank God that baby's asleep. And he's thinking, oh, right, now I've got you to myself. You know, there's two different trains of thoughts going on quite often, aren't there?
There is that too. Yes, the needs can change quite a bit. There's a bit of, in the research, they talk about an idea about skin hunger. That, you know, as human beings, as mammals, as human mammals, if you like, that we have just like we have appetites for other things that we need fulfilling, we have this idea of skin hunger. And with small babies in particular, if mothers are breastfeeding and they're often, and with small babies on them and being cuddled and all of that, then women are getting a good supply of skin hunger. Of their, you know, that being met.
Being nourished.
Being nourished. Being nourished, yeah. Exactly. But maybe partners are not necessarily getting as much. Although, Pinky, you know, we know that, fathering is changing quite a lot, and many more fathers are in that beautiful place of, in those nurturing spaces with babies. So for them, that skin hunger can be being fulfilled more. You know, still sometimes not as much as for the mother. So the mother, as you say, when the baby's asleep, the mother's saying, my body to myself for a little while. And their partner, of course, is thinking, her body might be available for me, you know, for our connection now. But so there can be a little bit of cross purposes with one another. So, and I guess I think still around this idea of support, you know, that if there's more support so that those moments when the baby's asleep are not the only moments that you might, you know, be able to take a bit of a breath, and it means there might be more availability for the couple relationship to just get a bit of a space in that whole busy time.
A bit of nourishing and nurturing.
Yeah.
Because it does. And you know, the new mothers have that hormonal connection, they call it your motherhood mindset or maternal preoccupation, that for that first 6 months after birth, your pituitary is still coming down to its normal size because you've been churning out all of these protective hormones for your baby. And, you know, of course, if you have a natural birth, you have big bursts of this oxytocin and prolactin, and breastfeeding brings them on too. And that's a good thing, but it just means that loving is directed towards your baby. And you know, that's just a biology, really, rather than a, you know, she only wanted me to have a baby. She didn't actually want to, doesn't want me now.
Yeah.
it's actually quite a physiological thing that's happening to the woman. And I think when women realise that it's okay, they can override it, whereas, you know, your baby smells better than a man, all that sort of stuff, which is just...
Yes.
Chemistry, it's that chemistry of attachment that I think once parents understand that, they can override it and work around it.
Well, they can be creative with it because, you and me, Pinky, sitting here, we're very thankful that all of the women in our lineage through our ancestors had strong maternal preoccupation when all our ancestors were young, because that's what helped us keep us all surviving and our family lines coming forward. So certainly we don't want to, you know, it's the biology is there because it's been part of our human survival mechanisms across all those years. However, of course, being human beings, we also have great capacity for creativity. So the biology isn't necessarily the full destiny, but in understanding it, as you say, then we can, you know, appreciate and respect it and why it's there, but also not get into that sort of personal realm necessarily of feeling like it's about you or it's about me or within the couple relationship, you know, but seeing, this is what it is. Well, how are we going to work around that? And, of course, I keep coming back to my key points before, support and a bit of an understanding about it's not necessarily always going to be about spontaneity. So they all sort of go together.
And to understand this, So what are some of the most common areas of I guess, disagreement or disconnection for couples? I mean, I tend to think, oh, you know, money's up there because you've got somebody earning and somebody not, and that can change the power, and there's sex, and then there's a division of labour, and then there's parenting styles and expectations, and then there's probably spreads right out to extended family and how you've been brought up. All sorts of things come into play when you add in a baby.
I know, it's a big, big melting pot, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So, so at a, I'm going to talk a little bit at a sort of psychological level, but you can see this has practical implication as well. So I'm going to talk about that there are some key tensions that, that come up within each of the individuals in the relationship, and then also tensions that, that play out into the relationship itself. And one of the, I mean, I'm going to talk about the sort of top four or five, if you like, of these. And depending on the particular couple, you know, you might have it, the list of one to five might be in a slightly different order. These tend to be the big sort of areas of tension once babies come into the picture. And I guess we're talking in particular about that first baby coming in, which makes all these big changes. Often if these sort of tensions and changes have been, you know, if a creative way has been found to go through them with a couple, of course, you could slip a few more babies in, Pinky, and, you know, it's all sorted. It's really that big, big dynamic change with that first baby. I don't know, maybe you need to get to about four or five babies before then, you know, you've got a whole lot of other adjustments. Once you've got to buy that bigger car, perhaps. Yeah.
You've got so much going on, really, you don't
expect
the small things.
No, exactly. It's, you know, a lot of the, these things I'm going to talk about have been sorted through, and so, you know, another baby coming in doesn't make such a huge change. So to set the scene a little bit, and this maybe isn't true for all of couples having their first baby, but it's still the general mode is this idea of this nuclear family, you know, in our culture, this thing of that the couple, when they fall in love and they get into a relationship with one another, or, you know, not necessarily getting married, of course, now, but in some way making that bond and then having that baby, that idea is that they're making their own new family, as opposed to, of course, many cultures in the world, that, that new coupling is part of a wider picture of an extended family, but we as a culture tend to have that idea of this individualizing and the nuclear family. So this, you know, has many benefits in our lives and in many areas of our relationships, but it doesn't work quite so well, particularly for this very early time with new babies, because there's not so much of the support around. So that's one thing. And what that also means is that this new new couple, this new family, one of the tasks is that they shift their psychological allegiance from their family of origin to the new family, you know, that they're creating. And as you said before, if we're thinking about that in terms of new babies coming in, that can start to put some tensions and stresses in terms of, well, how we're going to parent and who, which style of parenting, and parent the way your family parented or the way my family parented, and having to, you know, put that all in under the spotlight, if you like, and work out how as a couple they're going to form their own allegiance to one another and allegiance to their new family system, rather than, you know, following necessarily what their previous generations have done. So that's a whole new learning curve, and again would be something that would be great for them to start talking about before the baby comes along, of course. That's one of the underlying things. And another is, of course, the big shift that happens in terms of the role and the tension in this between the roles and responsibilities, the roles within the relationship and the responsibilities within the relationship. So there's this, you know, a lot of couples now come this idea of contemporary shared parenting, you know. We are pregnant. We are birthing. We are breastfeeding. We are, you know, sharing this load of, you know, the mothering and father, we're parenting rather than being mothers or fathers. And of course, this is an aspiration which has some wonderful, you know, benefits to mothers and fathers and children. But in the early time with pregnancy, birth, breastfeeding, it's an idea that is not necessarily carried through fully, because so much of what's happening is really still gendered in terms of it's happening in the mother's body and on the mother's body. So there's that aspiration towards this sharing of parenting and sharing what can be, but that takes a little while for that to become something that can really be possible, given the gender demands of female bodies still doing all of this, yeah? So what that creates that, and you've already talked about it in terms of, you know, the biology and the hormones and what have you, so there's that biological reality, breastfeeding, of course. But it can also be that, because now, at least for some period of time, the mother is generally at home with the baby, then it can be a sort of a bit of a slide into then a whole expectation that she will then be involved much more with the household and the household tasks. And so one of the big tensions in a couple relationship with when that first baby comes along is then the dividing up of the tasks of the household, which may, before the baby coming along, had been, you know, more, you know, a couple had worked out how they were going to deal with that, and they weren't, it's not so much necessarily gendered roles about what's men's work and what's women's work and what have you, although the statistics, of course, you know, still say that that's still pretty dominant to think like that. But even if couples have shared that a bit more equally before their babies come along, it's quite easy to slip back into tensions about, you know, whose job is it to do this bit and do that bit. And because the woman is at home with that baby more, then you can see that that sort of starts to fall more towards the mother. So that's a big area of tension and needing to be worked out. And so that's one of the big ones to spend some time discussing beforehand and work out ways to be creative around that after the baby's born. And you can see again there, Pinky, how much support needs to come into that picture. Another aspect.
Or somebody else, you know, somebody to do some gardening, or somebody to clean in, or something else if you can afford it.
They just have to be strategic, you know, thinking about the things that do need doing, the things that don't need doing, who have they got around who could be helpful to them.
Yeah, they delete or delegate.
Yes, exactly. Awesome. And generally, you know, people love to be around that energy of new babies and new families, so they're usually more than happy to be offering some sort of support. It's just that we're often feeling like we don't need it until things become too stressed when there's more of a crisis come on. Better to get the support in at a sort of regular way, so that those crises don't come forward. So that's one of the issues. The other, well, there's a few others, but I'm going to not to say that sex and sexual relationships are last, but I'm going to leave that to last, because it's a bigger set of things that we might in our conversation talk about a bit more in a bit more depth. But I wanted to say another thing that can happen, and this can be a bit unexpected for couples, which is that you alluded to it before when you talked about, you know, the beautiful picture of the mum and the dad and the baby, and it's all sweetness and light. Well, of course, there can be that whole range of unexpected feelings that can come forward. So the dream is one thing, but the reality is another. And so for couples, if they haven't got a more realistic picture, that can be quite a tension between them, about, you know, them judging one another, or feeling like it's, you know, you don't love me anymore, or that, you know, it's not supposed to be like this, it's supposed to be happy, it's supposed to be this, supposed to be that. So all of that can come into the mix. We also have, of course, those of us in our lives who feel like we've come from a family of origin where we feel like our parents were good enough, you know, and that family life is generally pretty sweet and you know, there's been enough love, and so we're feeling quite positive towards the way our family and our family life was, then that's a beautiful springboard for going into, you know, your own parenting experience. So presumably for people who feel like that, they'll want to shift and tweak a few things about how they're going to mother or father, because of course, generation by generation, we learn more. Generation by generation, the social situation changes. So there's always going to be some change. But at that basic core level, there's a feeling of that what's modeled and patterned in me is good enough. And I feel sort of confident that I'll be able to be a good parent. So that's a beautiful start. But of course, that's not always the case. And so for some individuals in relationships, the mother or the father or the couple themselves feel like they really want to do the parenting quite differently than their own parents. And so that, of course, just puts more of a... they've got to work harder because, you know, they've got to design new models and ways of doing things. So that's one thing. It's another... That can be a great bonding and creativity in the couple relationship, but it also is an added... learning curve that they're on. But of course, separate to what their conscious intent is, what can happen in that time when these babies come in is that at an unconscious or unaware level, that patterning within us about how we were parented or what family life is like, what mothers are like, what fathers are like, what couple relationships are like once they're mothers and fathers, that's living within us. And so sometimes in the stresses and changes of the early time with our new babies, some of that can come up and come out and start to be sort of these unconscious motivations that we're not quite sure where they come from and we don't quite have a handle on. The next thing they seem to overtake us, or we start to think about things differently. So that can be a tension between couples, particularly, I guess, if they're coming from different types of family system with different, as you mentioned before, different ideas about how to parent. And that's not only living in their conscious way of thinking about parenting, but it's also sort of stimulated at this more unconscious or unaware level that's pushing some of their feelings. So that can make really quite a hot situation for couples to have to be working with. So that's another area that, it's a bit unexpected for some people. So then, Pinky, will we go on to talk now about some of the more issues to do with couple intimacy and sexuality, or is there anything else you wanted to mention beforehand?
Yeah, yep. No, I think that would be good. That, you know, is there a typical or normal expectation that works out in reality? I saw something the other day and I was really surprised about it, and I didn't keep it. It was just a couple of weeks ago about, you know, couples and how often they actually had sex in the first year of their baby's life. And it was less than a handful of times. It kind of surprised me, but... You know, people have an expectation or a typical or a normal expectation, and then in reality it's going to be different. And I think a lot of women believe that, or a lot of couples are thinking, well, the 6-week check is the, you know, the green light if they haven't ventured out yet. And, you know, whereas some people will obviously need more time. And then there's, of course, the effects of giving birth and different birth experiences, aren't there? I mean, I know with my own readiness, I've got 5 kids, and after each of them, it just seemed to depend how many fingers were poked in my vagina during labour, how I responded, or how quickly I was ready.
Yeah.
So get on to that, Rhea, because you've got some good stuff on.
Yes, I know. Well, wouldn't we delight if women came out of their birth experiences feeling like that the birth had been an extension or an integrated part of their sense of sexuality and their sense of their sexual identity, and that breastfeeding was also, wouldn't that be wonderful? Yes, always happen, but it is the ideal. Yeah. So to go back to what might be more the reality, I think that. There's quite a bit to say, but I'm trying to just bring it down into a few sort of areas. So one is within the couple themselves, but one is this sort of expectation more at a social and cultural level. And I want to say a little bit about that first of all, because this sort of sets the scene. Because I think that for couples in sort of contemporary eras, the pressure on sexuality is, and the focus on sexuality is stronger than maybe it has been a generation ago or even a few eras ago. So I think generally in, you know, in our awareness generally in life, there's a strong focus on sexuality, which has got, you know, brilliant in one hand, but on the other hand can be a pressure or can have not such, sometimes some negative effect. And so just to put that in that picture, I mean, in years gone by when marriage was that institution that in the main held together, I mean, it might be that within the marriage, the couple relationship wasn't as vital or close or what have you, but the marriage itself held together as a structure. Now, in a way, there was something about that that meant that, you know, the early time with babies and with families, it sort of held together even, and the couple were able to find a way to work with that within the marriage, even though their couple intimacy might not have been so hot, yeah? Well, now, of course, we've got this whole, we've shifted to a place where there's an expectation that the couple relationship should be sparkling all the time. And that if the couple relationship isn't sparkling, whatever, you know, in whatever ways that might mean, and sexuality being an expected part of it, if it's not, if the couple relationship it hasn't got all that going for it, well, then the whole thing won't hold together. Yeah, it's not the marriage as institution or the couple bond as institution. So it means that the time when babies come in, which, you know, can mean, and I'll come back to this point, can mean that maybe the sexuality isn't so strong between the couple for a period of time, that they can put some other fractures into the relationship because of this idea that that should be part of a sparkling part of the couple relationship, even though there's these other stresses that mean that maybe it's not such a strong part of their relationship at that point. I hope I'm saying that clearly. About that. Yep. Yep. So good.
Yeah.
So this is part of the bigger picture, yeah? That's part of there for all couples because of just the eras that we're living in. But nonetheless, separate to that, of course, couples, you know, they do want to be expressing we do want that lovingness and that expression of the vitality in the couple relationship. We don't want that to dry up and all that's, you know, loveliness to go into just the kids. We want the couple relationship to be vital as well. So, but there can be a tension here. And you remarked on it a little bit before when you were talking about the biology or the, you know, the hormones that are going on. So I'm coming back to my pet theme here a little bit, or one of my pet themes, which is about this idea of spontaneity. So let's think back, the couple's relationship before those babies, then often their relationships and their sexual relationships and intimate relationship were based around this idea of spontaneity and various triggers and things that when they felt like it, that they would engage with one another, and that was prized as being really, you know, great stuff between us as a couple. Well, for a few reasons, once the babies are here, we've already mentioned them in terms of the demands of the baby, but also, of course, as you've said, in those early weeks, months, the hormones in the mother are biologically primed for the baby's survival. And so because of that, it means that the hormones that are often driving the mother's libido are lessened. And so if the mother or the couple are relying on spontaneity, and spontaneity often in our sexuality is driven by the libido being driven by our hormones. But if the mother's hormones are operating in that same way, well then, if she's used to relying on the juiciness that comes with her hormones peaking for her sexual libido, then that's going to be happening in those early weeks, maybe months of the pregnancy, and as you're saying, into that first year even. So that's not going to be, because of course the father's libido is still on its, you know, hormonal rhythm, so there can be a mismatch there, for what we call a desire discrepancy, which I'll come back to in a moment because that's an important thing to understand. So coming back to what I'm saying about this spontaneity, I think that, you know, if couples can get over that in so many ways in their couple relationship once kids come on board, that's going to be their best tools. And again, one of them is in the realm of sexuality. So rather than waiting on the hormones or the spontaneities, there's something about this planning and making time and space for, and, you know, be great to have on board in your support circle, people who know the importance of this and who say, yes, I'm going to come over and look after those kids so you can go off and have a good session. You know, I'll just take the, you know, I'll be in the other room, you do, you know, just go and do your thing, who would support you. They might support you to go to a, you know, an appointment somewhere, but would they support you to have a good role in the hay or what have you? That's what you want to know about. So for couples to have some planning, making time and space for not only the couple, the intimacy in all ways, but also within their sexuality. And of course, we know that in terms of our sexuality, it's not just our hormones that play a part, but that creativity in our thinking and in our heads and our planning and looking forward to is part of that boosting of the libido as well. So that's one of the things that couples have to understand, and particularly in terms of the woman's libido not necessarily being linked anymore to her hormones if the couple are wanting to be engaging and back into that juiciness of their sexual life. You know, before the hormones really are coming back on board again. So that's one thing. To come to talk about this idea of this desire discrepancy, and this is so crucial, I think, to understand this. So this is in a couple relationship where one of the party in the relationship has a higher sexual desire than the other. Now, across a long-term relationship, and maybe for couples even before they've had their first baby, maybe they've had to chart their way through moments like this before, you know, because our desire can be, you know, for tiredness, for illness, for stress, for new jobs, for this, for that. So there are other reasons why this desire discrepancy might happen, or it might just be that for a couple, anyway, their natural level of sexual desire is there's a discrepancy in that. And I think what the research says, of course, that for most of us, when we come into a new relationship, our desire is very high on both sides, and we can both be thinking, oh, we both really, you know, love sex as much as the other. But as time goes on, for a whole lot of other reasons, that can shift. So this desire discrepancy, as I say, can come in at other points in the couple relationship. But one of the big times when it comes on board is, of course, for all the reason that we've been talking about, at the point once these new babies come in, particularly in this situation of the first baby. So if a desire discrepancy gets going, and we can understand all the reasons in this in the context of new babies, but if it does, then and of course, if couples can't see that this is a part of a, you know, understand the reasons and take it out of that, this being something about personally about you or about me, but seeing it rather more in terms of what you were saying before, that the biology and the changes, then they could be more creative about it rather than getting caught into a tension and a difficulty between one another where they're thinking it's specifically directed at one or other. Because what happens in a situation of desire discrepancy that is unable to be creatively talked about and communicated about and understood starts to push down then into another cycle happening, which is what's called the pursuer distancer cycle. And the pursuer distancer cycle starts to look like that the person who has the higher libido is starting to pursue their partner who has the lower libido for sexual activity, for sexual engagement. Yeah, and you know, we might, in the context of new babies coming in, although not always, but we might think that, well, that's likely to be then the woman with the lower libido and the partner with the higher libido, and so the partner with the higher libido is pursuing the mother in this case for sexual activity. And that cycle then of the pursuer distancer cycle starts to play out in terms of the pursuer who is, you know, hungry and desiring sexual activity is getting more preoccupied with, you know, the sex that they're not having, and so pursuing more strongly for getting the sex that they're wanting. And the distancer, who is not got that libido at that point or that desire, is distancing more and more, so that it can become an entrenched cycle of one pursuing for sex in all sorts of opportunities or taking what they think might be opportunities, and the distancer, unfortunately, distancing more and more from some of the other shared intimacies between the couple because they feel like that might give a signal to their partner that they're up for sex, when in fact then they're not feeling that, you know, that that's where they want to go.
But you're refusing the cut or avoiding the cuddles, because the cuddles are going to lead to sex where you don't need to go anyway, or you don't want to go.
Yeah, yeah. So it becomes a, you know, if couples don't understand it, and it can become a very undermining of the good quality of nurturing relationship that they have. You know, the just even the hand holding or the cuddling on the couch, or, you know, those things that in the past would have been part of a wider range of their sexual and sensual intimacy, even they can drop off. And it's a sad thing when that happens. But this is the, I mean, there's more to say about that, but I won't go into any more depth. But if couples can understand this is happening because of this desire discrepancy, then that's one way to start discussing it and hopefully alleviating, nipping it in the bud, if you like. Because the further thing to understand that's sort of sitting underneath all of this is what's called the CISS continuum. So if you're a visual learner,
how you describe this.
If you're a visual learner, you know, I'm a visual learner, I'm a visual teacher, so I love to be doing this on whiteboards or butcher's paper or what have you, but we're talking about it. So I'm hoping that that people can get a sense of a continuum, a continuum. One thing
visualize,
leading to another,
lady.
To another, to another. Visualize, yes. So we have the we have the CISS continuum. So what it stands for, C stands for communication, I for intimacy, S for sensuality, S for sexuality. So the continuum being, and remember, if we're thinking about continuums, then of course continuums can go this way or they can go that way, depending on which end you start from. I guess probably typically for us, we read from the, you know, the left-hand side to the right, so we can think about it that way. But of course, many cultures read the other way, so depending on where you come from. So I'm not wanting to get people to get set into thinking that there's a right way of doing this. It's just that this is the continuum. However, and I'm going to talk about generalities here, and of course, in talking about generalities, of course, it's not true in every case, but we can talk about things in general because enough times it is true. So one of the general understandings is that for women, the way this continuum works is the CISS model. So that means that in terms of sexuality, for many women, their pathway to sexuality is to feel like they're having the communication with, you know, who their sexual body partner. So the communication leads them to feel that intimacy with their partner, that closeness, that openness to one another, which leads them into their sensuality. And then from their sensuality, that leads them to sexuality. So that's the CISS pathway of the continuum, coming at it that way, is seen more generally to be the pathway for a woman into her sexuality. Yeah. However, the generality is that for men, the pathway works in the other direction, that sexuality leads them into their sensuality leads them to a feeling of intimacy, and the intimacy leads them to a feeling of then more openness in their communication. If you could see me doing this, Pinky, you'd be seeing my arms going along and pointing as if I'm drawing this on a whiteboard or something. But
I've seen you do.
So for them,
maybe they could write it on a big piece of paper, and that would give them that visual.
Exactly, and have it to discuss with their partner. So for the men, let me just go over that again. So for the men, often the sexuality, the connection at the sexual level, opens them to their sensuality. The sensuality brings that feeling of intimacy and closeness with their partner, which opens them more to communication. So for a couple, and we're talking about a couple in this early time after their baby, maybe their first baby or another baby, for a couple, you know, at the core, I guess, you know, couples are wanting that intimate connection of feeling like they're in love and that they're loved and that they're supported and communicating with one another. So they're both generally wanting that communication and that intimacy. Now, if their pathway along this continuum is from opposite ends, then for the male partner who is perhaps pursuing his, you know, the new mother in this case, pursuing them for sex, then the woman can be, you know, feeling, oh, all he wants is sex, where she's feeling like she wants this feeling of intimacy and this support and this connection and communication, and she's feeling, oh, he wants his sex, he doesn't want anything else. But in fact, for the man, often their way to come to that same common point, which is to feel that connection and closeness with one another, it's through the sexual activity, it's through the sexuality and the sensuality. And so it's not as simple as saying he just wants sex or just to get his rocks off or whatever. No, the driver is to be part of that intimate connection again. And particularly from in the early time with the mother and the baby, where that very strong intimate bond is there between the mother and the baby. For some of the dads, they're orbiting around the outside, wondering how they can get into that beautiful, you know, loving connection. And so that can drive that feeling that, you know, that their way of feeling into that intimacy is through that contact that they get through the sexual engagement with their partner. But if that's, is not able because the mother isn't getting, you know, it's not, the pathways aren't joining, if you like, then it's very sad to see that starts to make, you know, can make quite a wounding into the relationship. Where they're starting to very much judge one another or blame one another, or, you know, she thinks that he's only after sex and he thinks that she, you know, she doesn't love me anymore because the sex isn't on the agenda. And it can, as we know, unravel and create a situation which is far from what the couple had been hoping and dreaming for when they were feeling that love and connection with one another and opening into an expanded family. So it's for those of us who work in the postnatal arena with couples or with couples in their relationships, it's a great sadness that many of us don't understand how this works. And then in understanding it, like you suggested before, if we understand these things, then it just opens up a possibility for much more discussion and creativity about how we then go about it. So instead of the mother viewing, if her partner's putting sex on the table again, instead of, you know, judging him or feeling like he's only wanting sex, she can be more open and loving towards that this is part of his want and need to be connected with me and, you know, me and baby and us. And if the male partner can see that the mother's pathway into sexuality is about the communication, the intimacy, the sensuality, and of course that would translate at this time with new babies into sort of support and feeling the intimacy of connection around the vulnerability about how not only the tiredness but the big changes that are going on for me and the big learning curve I'm on, and this is what my day looks like now, and need to communicate something about that with you because I don't have the sort of day that like I used to have, where we used to come home and we used to make that intimate communication and connection about what we did in our work and our job and all of that, all those shared things. Now my day is quite different to your day, but I still need and want to talk about it and to feel that, you know, we're on the same page now. So she wanting and needing that, and if the partner can understand that to enter into that more, then more likely that they're both going to end up going their pathways through that entire continuum. And a bit more sex is on the agenda, Pinky. Which is bonding glue,
right,
in terms of the couple.
Somehow.
Yeah, yeah,
mm.
yeah.
Mm. So no, that's all that emotional stuff and that psychological stuff. It's really helpful to understand that, because you can start thinking, for goodness sake, you know, get out of the queue. I've got enough to do with this baby. You know, stop acting like a needy little boy and, you know, piss off or help me.
Yes. So to understand where,
you know, or if you help me, if you help me, I'll have time for you. You know, that's sort of fairly typical kind of.
They
nibble, but they eat away at life, you know, at the relationship. And you don't really want to have a divorce over who does the dishes.
No, I know. And I mean, of course, but that lack of a sort of a strong connection not that it only comes through sexuality, but of course this is one of the great gifts of sexuality, that bonding, you know. And if there's a strong core at that, then maybe sometimes it doesn't matter who does the dishes, that, you know, that's not the issue, because there's something richer at the core and the heart of the couple relationship, which means those, mind you, if it's always about, you know, if the dishes always fall to one person, that can be wearing away for a whole lot of reasons,
can't
it?
Yeah.
I just was, as you said something before, it triggered something more for me to remember around that pursuer distancer cycle, you know. So I'm taking a step back from the underlying continuum being that communication, intimacy, sexuality, sensuality, sexuality, or the other way, sexuality, sensuality, intimacy, communication, that continuum, to come back to the idea of the pursuer distance cycle, where the person with the higher libido is pursuing the person with the lower libido, and we get that pursuer distance cycle. So what can happen in all of that is that the you know, relationship where the couple have care for one another, so the distancer can start to feel guilty, of course, or feel, you know, poor thing, or, you know, their partner, they want to have connection with them, they want to be nurturing to them, and so if they feel like if sex is the way, well, then they will offer sex, even though they don't have desire for sex. And now, if that's, and that can, you know, within couple relationships, I'm sure they're bound on either on long-term relationships, times when that's the case. And you might be familiar with Bettina Arndt's research on some of this, and where she says, well, sometimes, you know, women just need to enter in, and probably also sometimes men have to enter in. And once you enter into a sexual engagement, sometimes, surprise, surprise, you find you like it.
Okay.
rather, you know, so that the libido can come once the engagement started, rather than feeling like, well, the libido needs to be there before the engagement starts. So there's that. But over time, if in this pursuer distancer cycle, the distancer is just offering sex where there's no desire and not getting into it, then that starts to become what is commonly called mercy sex. And it can be an emotionally and intimately dry affair where it all starts to come down to just sex rather than any of this other engagement. And over time, that's again very eroding, because the person with the lower desire, their desire never comes up, and in fact it often gets less because of this, the nature of the feeling of offering the sex without desire. And from the point of view of the person who's pursuing for the sex, it's not entirely satisfying, and they know that there's not that quality of strong engagement, so it becomes corroded as well at that core. So and also on both sides of that, so, you know, so the distancer can feel guilty, and also the pursuer can feel guilty. They can feel like, you know, that they're, you know, that it, they're overbearing about it, or that they're obsessed by it, or that they're, you know, they can obviously see that their partner's not really willing or wanting at this point, and yet they feel compelled to want to keep trying to engage. And so both parties, neither party really ends up being happy or satisfied in that. So to discuss it and to be creatively thinking about how that can be brought forward so that the couple are really coming to a place of that shared intimacy again, and sexuality being a strong bonding part of all of that, that's the aim. You asked before, you know, this thing, that research about the first year of life after a baby was born. Another thing just to put into that, of course, we remember, so depending on how the birth's gone, there can be healing and physicality to you know, wait on. I mean, the 6 week check might be one point, but for some women, of course, the because of the way the birth has been there.
Sometimes the physiotomies and things can take a few months before they
exactly
really heal.
Yes. So all of those things can be part of the waiting. Also, of course, just the tiredness and the, depending on, you know, if the baby's one of those more called, you know, fussy babies and more demanding. So there's a whole lot of reasons why in those first few months it may not be just that 6 week mark where women are ready. And also, as I said before, if they're waiting on their hormones to boost their libido, well, maybe those hormones aren't kicking in for, you know, quite some time. So I There's another bit of research that's come out which is talks about that women, if they're not engaging in sexual activity, the longer they don't have sex, then the sort of longer they can go without it, if you like. So what I think of when I think of couples after that first baby, if I'm doing work with a couple, then I would think that, you know, somewhere between that 3 to 6 months, I mean, which isn't to say that some couples aren't engaging in sexual activity much earlier than that, but if in that, because I guess, Pinky, we think that, you know, over that first 3 months, I mean, unless it's a particularly demanding situation from the birth or the baby, most couples are sort of getting the hang of the whole thing, and there's a little bit more spaciousness, a bit more energy left for, you know, other aspects of their life. So you'd be thinking into that 3 to 6 months that maybe there's a bit of more space to engage with one another and the you know, the intimacy or the shared things that as a couple that you're bringing forward from before the baby, now bringing them back into your couple life. But if after, you know, if through that 6 to 12 months there's not much of an engagement in, well, I guess we're presupposing that the relationship before the baby came was one that had a lot of sexual intimacy, may or may not be the case, but if it had been, that you would think that in that 6 to 12 months after the birth of the baby that there'd be a re-engagement, yeah? And if that's not happening, then I would be, if I was doing counselling work with such a couple, then I'd be wondering what's going on about this cycle that I'm talking about, what's going on in terms of are they waiting for these magic, you know, spontaneous moments, or have they got enough support around to give them a bit of space where they can, you know, relate with one another. So I'd be looking at some of those things to and what could help the mother or the partner to problem solve around those things so that they can give better energy towards this engagement with one another. But I think that sometimes it drags on. It can drag on for that long period of time because everybody's waiting just for this libido is for spontaneously just, you know, take you over and start to drive everything again. Well, yeah, maybe, but if not, then
you
that doesn't
got
mean
a brain.
To say exactly.
You know, you've got a conscious brain that can say, look, we need to do this and we need this connection and we need to I mean, communication's obviously a big one, but you can't just not, I mean, you can't live like brother and sister forever. It's not really.
Prioritize your relationship.
You prioritize your relationship. I guess that's what I'm saying with having a brain. You know, you prioritize your relationship, and if that means that, you know, grandma takes the baby out or you go out for coffee or whatever, it happens.
Yes.
I mean, the baby will be asleep. And actually, I think sometimes, thinking back to my own thing, sometimes it's easier to have sex when the baby's awake because the baby can be there playing in a safe place and you can go and have sex. You're not going to get woken up by the baby. And if you want to candlelight, you can put the baby somewhere where there's candles, not around the baby. The baby will watch the flickering candlelight goo-goo on the floor while you nick off and do what you need to do.
Yes.
You don't even have to be in the same room.
Well, I think what you're talking about there is what I guess some of the thing more practical aspects that I put under what I'm saying, creativity, you know. So for couples, depending on how long they've been together and what have you, we sort of have sexual habits, you know, about when it happens, and it happens here and there, or, you know, in this location or that location or what have you. But maybe that doesn't fit so well with how things are going with the baby. Maybe all your sexual activity happens at night time, whereas of course if you're getting somebody to be looking after the child, it's usually much easier for people to be minding children during the daytime rather than the night time, unless they're at a point where they're sleeping. But in that early evening where somebody might say, well, I'll look after the baby and can go out for a romantic dinner,
that takeaways at home and you have
exactly
to have
that
intimate time at home.
Exactly, or brunch is often an easy, you know, that's often a time when babies or little people are, you know, happy to be out for walks and what have you. And so just having to be a bit more creative about prioritising and making that time and space, thinking and a bit of planning, and then, of course, now to come back to a bit of the brain chemistry here, when we have pleasurable experiences, and, you know, presumably We're assuming that when the sexual activity is happening, it is pleasurable experience. So you get a whole lot of that uplift that comes in the brain chemistry as well as the intimacy connection and everything. But with that idea of planning and looking forward to, we've also got the whole anticipatory system, which has us excitedly and, you know, happily and looking forward to something and that building. So getting a double whammy of good stuff, both in terms of the expectation and the excitement and the waiting and then also the experience itself. So couples need to get over this idea. You can hear me, I'm saying it again. Get over this idea of that everything that is good is happening spontaneously and eventually, and sometimes, yes, that is good, but in periods of time, and this is one of them, in this early time after the first new baby or any new baby, is to be thinking of the great delights of a bit of forethought and foreplanning and making, getting the support in so that you can make those things happen. That would be my take-home message, Pinky.
Right, yeah. So yes, because we've done our hour now. I was going to get you to do some other things, but we'll go, before we do wrap up, you know, on this positive note, Your take-home message about couples, how can they nourish their relationship with each other as well as parents? What's your take-home message? I mean, you've given them lots of fabulous things to understand, to discuss with their partners. Okay, let's have a take-home message.
Yeah, so the take-home message is that okay, so it's being real about the situation and then, and I know I'm going back to it, but this is what I'm saying here is stemming from the point of view of that sometimes the way we go about this early time with new babies is actually being driven not so much by our conscious mind but by the unconscious processes of our own early parenting when we were children in our families and the way the couple were interacting, i.e. our mother and father. So that's welling in the situation. So the thing to be putting change into that is, again, this overused word that I've used is creativity, but being creative. And that means in terms of the couple, communicating, talking these things through, and then working together in creative ways to make that time and space for engagement as a couple. That you're not now just mother and father, you still are lovers and intimates, an intimate couple, and within a reasonable time frame, given all the early stuff with babies and the demands, but to give that the energy and the creativity that it deserves, that ongoing aspect of your relationship. That would be my take-home message. So whether that means takeaways instead of going out for the candlelight dinner, or it means if some of the ways that you used to love to relate was that you shared films, to going to films or to the theatre or to the play, well, of course, now there's lots that you can get online. You know, you can decide that you're going to have a international film festival in your lounge room by, I don't know whether people get, they probably don't get DVDs or download or what have you. And so instead of going out, you're doing it at home, or this month it's going to be Italian food that we're going to because that was our favourite restaurant, but we're having a go at doing those dishes at home. Or how can you creatively bring the things that were the things that you loved in your couple relationship before the baby came, how can you bring those into this changed circumstance with this baby so that you're still nurturing the great things that you loved as a couple to do before and now doing them in this changed context? That's my take-home message.
That's great. Yes, and we'll be positive and loving and happy. And now, where can people find out more, Rhea? You've obviously got birthingwisdom.com.au, which is Rhea's website.
Yes. Yeah. And I've got a Facebook page, which is, again, the Birthing Wisdom Facebook page. So going to Facebook and then putting on Birthing Wisdom onto it. Some people look for Rhea Dempsey on Facebook, I guess, but my Facebook page for all of this is not my name. It's Birthing Wisdom. And Pinky, just at the moment, of course, we're talking about more parenting things, but because of the book, I've been really focusing much more on my birthing aspect, the aspects about birthing. And so that's what maybe people will find on the website. In terms of... But, of course, that's a good setup for things going well into the postnatal period. So if people want to look for the book, all those details will be on either the Facebook page or my website. In terms of the couple counselling, then I do my work out of two clinics. One is Fertile Ground Health Group in East Melbourne. Again, details are on my website. Or Mama, which is over in Kensington. And again, details on my website if people want to follow up in any way like that. And then, of course, maybe it's the second or third book, Pinky.
Maybe. Maybe. Because
yes.
You've done the birthing with confidence, then you can do, yes. The couples with a new baby. I think that would be another good book. Don't make it take as long as this one did, Rhea.
I know.
We've been waiting for years for Rhea's book because she's been telling her she has to write it down because she's got so much wisdom there. But look, it's a big job and it's beautiful and it's a great book. So I'm actually going to snap a photo on my phone and put it up on Facebook while I've got it here on the table.
Right.
That's great. So thank you, Rhea, for all of this. Good information today.
Yes. Well, one of the things you and I share is that not only this passion for doing this, but, I mean, the passion just for people to have information that can help them. Yeah. And we hope that
we love to talk about it
because we feel like it's useful. Yeah.
And there's a real maze to try and find the help that you need when you do need it. And when you're really vulnerable and overwhelmed with a new baby, it's very hard to even get in that state of mind to think, what do I need, let alone where do I go?
Exactly. Yeah. And just to say one thing on that, often when we're in most need and feeling vulnerable, that's the point when it's hardest to reach out, because we're often in a shame dynamic as well, which puts another barrier to reaching out. So can I go back to my usual, which is, forget about spontaneity and thinking about it, you know, planning, starting to organise your things beforehand, organising supports, all of those things, not waiting on then things being, you know, getting to such a point of distress that shame starts to come into the picture and you're even less likely to be reaching out, and then it comes down to a crisis point before some sort of support comes into the situation. I could say more, but let's leave it at that.
That's right, yes, because all the frozen casseroles in the world can't prepare you for those changes to your relationship.
No.
You know, we need to make plans. Yeah, it's hard. And reaching out, and there's no shame in reaching out. Often, you know, going and having a bit of counselling, it might only be a couple of sessions, but it pushes you back on to, it's not always the work you do during the counselling session, it's the work that you do together afterwards, because you've been opened up to things that you can discuss, things that you can change, you know, how to do it. Because I think as a couple, you often don't know how to do it when you get a blockage.
Yes, yep, exactly. And it's not only about seeking help, you know, from professionals, but just really that support network around you. We say it a bit, you know, lightly, but that adage of it takes a village to raise a child, it's got a hell of a lot going for it.
It does. Otherwise, you're just the poor mama. You know, you've got the cart full of rocks, and it's more rocks than you can.
Yes.
You can pull all by one person.
Yeah.
Yes. So thank you very much, and everybody have a great week or month, whatever. You know, have a great day, and be as gentle to yourself and your beloved as you are to your baby.
Yes.